Hi, I'm Teresa Wiesor, your host of 1 in 10. In today's episode, Collateral Damage, Kids and the Internet Privacy Wars, I speak with Justin Fitzsimmons, Associate Vice President at the National White Collar Crime Center. Now, full disclosure, I've known Justin for ages, basically forever, and he's served as an NCA board member for many years. Many of you know him, too, as a renowned speaker at conferences far and wide on technology-facilitated crime. And while Justin and I could have spoken about many, many technology issues, as you'll hear, instead, what we're doing is really raising the alarm about the ways in which technology companies, social media outlets, and online privacy advocates are now purposely pitting adult privacy rights against the protection and safety of children. Think end-to-end encryption is totally innocuous? Well, we hope you think again. What if that means that pedophiles can endlessly trade child sexual abuse images online with impunity? And how do we, as advocates for children, keep issues of child protection front and center for policymakers, for tech and social media, and ultimately for all Americans? I know you'll be as interested as I am in this conversation with Justin. Please take a listen. Hi, Justin. Welcome to 1 in 10.
Hi, Teresa. It's nice to see you, and thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to be a part of it.
So you and I have talked many times, as you know, about technology and all that I don't understand about it, actually, is usually how it goes. But I'm wondering, when you first developed this interest in the intersection between technology and child abuse?
For me, it was actually part of a case as a baby prosecutor many years ago. And it was one where a case was dropped on my desk and it was a figure out how to do this. And it was back then a child pornography case, what we call CSAM today. And so my sort of passion for protecting kids in a digital world sort of all got its genesis from that moment. The classes that I went to and the trainings that I went to learn how to do that, starting with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, through where, coincidentally enough, I now work, the National White Collar Crime Center, and some of the classes that they had all brought me to sort of the point where I am today.
When you think about the way that, you know, this field has progressed over the last few years, and when you think about the future of it as well, what are some trends that you see that you find worrisome when thinking about technology facilitated child abuse and other aspects of this, abusive images, all of that?
That's actually a really interesting and pointed question. And it's what I see as cycles in terms of the sort of technology abuse that's going on or the exploitation that's going on. And whether it's, you know, the technology is actually the culprit in the case in terms of the technology is where the crime actually occurs, or whether the technology is simply the facilitation to the crime, such as, you know, meeting children in a certain space. And so we've seen that sort of evolve over the last 23 years that I've been involved in the field, whether it's with the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force's prosecutor's offices or on the training side. And to me, the biggest fear that I have about this is the nuances that go into the different types of technology that are out there. And as we get this pushback, and some of it is legitimate, but some of it is just kind of, you know, the circling of the wagons on privacy issues. And the more that society becomes entrenched in this idea of, I want to have unbreakable encryption, I want to have the government not be able to get to any of my stuff, I want to be able to go to like a dark net where I'm on a separate, basically, internet platform where I think I'm anonymous. And for the most part, I am, depending on where I go and what I'm doing. And as we get more and more of those types of situations, I think that's where it's going to be much more difficult to A, protect kids, and B, actually find who's responsible for the exploitation. That's the one side. And then the second side is just the technology itself. And there are lots of studies that sort of point to this, where the normalization of child sexual exploitation and even physical abuse to children has promulgated itself through technology. And what I mean by that is there are now all kinds of different augmented reality and virtual worlds where people can go in and create a virtual child and then offer that child up for whatever sexual activity somebody is interested in. And there are people who are paying people to do this. And this isn't a new concept. This has been around Second Life. There was a news story all the way back to 2009. And this was occurring on Second Life in a specific island that was created by a user. And so we've got the same type of things happening. But when you think about, and I'm not sure if you've heard of this term yet, but metaverses are how they're describing it. And metaverses is Facebook's version of this. And really what it is it's a combination of a virtual world and augmented reality and the ability to have chats and social interaction with others. And so if you think about that, if I go into a metaverse, if you will, and I create this fictitious avatar, I can be groped by anybody. And so if mine is a child, that is setting up the idea that this is okay behavior. And so that normalization, it really kind of pushes out some of the people who may not have ever done this, but now they see it and they see it over and over and over again. And so they're acting upon it.
I'm pausing here because I'm just thinking about what a disturbed person would even think of to develop that in the first place. And you know, you just sound like this is how you spend your time thinking up alternate universes in which you can abuse children. It's just,
well, obviously those universes were not created for this purpose, but just like with any technology, you have these offenders, yeah. Correct. These offenders are instantaneously figuring out how can I use this for the purposes I want, which is going to be criminal in nature or, you know, to exploit kids.
You know, one of the things that I was thinking of as you were talking was sort of this issue around privacy and the way that these privacy concerns have been basically, and I think it's really a false dichotomy, but it's like groups like, you know, Facebook and others have basically said, we want to do end-to-end encryption for the purposes of privacy. Really, more or less, they don't want to get sued for things and have to involve themselves. I think in law enforcement investigations is why they're so very interested in it. But what I hate is this pitting of privacy issues against child abuse. And so I remember I was on this panel and it was so maddening to listen to, it was a woman, I won't name her, but basically she was like, yes, but think of all the Uyghurs in China who we don't want them identified and mistreated when they're trying to oppose the Chinese government. And it's like, yes, that's terrible. But when you start pitting one human rights abuse against another, you kind of miss the point of the whole exercise. And so it just struck me when you were talking about that. I was like, that is something we, as child abuse professionals, have to involve ourselves in these discussions, because I feel like when you hear the tech world talk about it, they talk about it in a really abstract kind of way that doesn't always truly account for the amount of suffering that children have attached to these cases and the sort of disadvantage we're placing law enforcement in this. Can you just talk a little bit about even conversations you've been a part of with this? I'm not saying name names, but just, you know, how do you approach these conversations in tech where people are like, yeah, but privacy? Because I do think this happens more and more.
It's funny that the story that pops into my head instantaneously, and I won't say the internet service provider that was involved in it, but it's one that has done some activity to protect kids. I will definitely say that. They've definitely been towards the upper end of that spectrum. But then they introduced a technology that law enforcement could use to help protect kids. And then they decided that based on a privacy concern, they were only going to use it on their own network in limited circumstances where there had to be something that was being shared with others. So if I just store all the data that I want to, and now we can talk about the cloud and everybody knows what I'm talking about. But so if I'm storing all my data on a cloud server and I'm not sharing it with anybody, then their position was they weren't going to review any of the things that I had up there to determine whether or not it was child exploitation. So in essence, giving me a free pass, if you will.
A free storage library. Yeah,
exactly. That is exactly what I was going to say.
Wow.
A free storage locker of stuff that I can get into, but that they won't get into and the government won't know about. And what was really interesting in the conversation that I was being told about was that there was a person who was very pro-law enforcement that worked for this agency who said, this entity who said, I kid you not, Justin, it was like you think about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and now there's a fifth, and that fifth one is riding a white horse, and her name is Privacy. Mm. And he said, he tried to argue, well, what about the kids' rights? What about their rights not to be sexually abused, not to be kidnapped, not to be exploited? And he said that was met with this wall of privacy argument that was all encompassing, and that it was privacy, privacy, privacy. They were going to err on the side of privacy. And to me, that was just I don't understand how somebody could come to that decision. And so I agree with you 100%. When we're thinking about rights against rights, there are ways, I think, to protect the people in China who are pushing back against the regime, or in any country where they're pushing back against a regime, versus those who would share what we know is contraband. And that, to me, is the biggest issue here, is that on the one hand, you're talking about protecting somebody's freedom of speech. On the other hand, you're talking about protecting someone who has illegal material, or they're engaging in illegal acts. And so to me, those are two entirely different things. And somebody could argue, well, it's an illegal act in that country to do this. And I say, I totally get that. And so in that particular circumstance, there may be things that you could do to protect that person's privacy. But to have this sort of blanket idea that, you know, we're going to protect somebody over here, who doesn't matter what state you're in now in the United States, any of the things that we're talking about would fit a state statute as a crime or the federal statutes as a crime. And so to me, it's a no-brainer.
Just makes me wonder if what's going to move some of the companies off this a little bit will involve civil lawsuits from victims. Because if you look at other examples where corporations or institutions have had to be moved off their position about something that involved abuse victims, it's been really adult survivors suing and saying, you know, you facilitated or helped facilitate a crime against me by your policies or procedures or whatever. And it just makes me wonder if they're opening themselves up to liability they're not really thinking about by allowing people to store these huge volumes of abusive images, you know.
If you look at some of the sort of changes in statutes over the last 3 or 4 years as it relates to, and the push behind it was human trafficking, was to try and get the back pages and to try and get, you know, Craigslist at the time, which Craigslist, their response was what you would hope you would get from an ISP, which was they made it very difficult for anybody to do that on their network. Backpage, on the other hand, decided to try and make a profit out of it. And so when you look at the way that the statutes that used to give them complete protection from liability have been altered, that's the first step in that. And so to say that you are somewhat responsible for this is, I think, a good first step. The problem is that if you look at the flip side of the statute, where it's great that it gives the attorney general's offices the ability to go after, on behalf of victims, these large corporations, the thresholds and the burdens of proof are so high that it's going to be really difficult for them to be successful in that. And I have yet to see one, and it would be in the media if there was, where you have this sort of this big case, if you will, in this big decision where they're actually held accountable. And so we don't have that. I always have thought, like, in the back of my head, it's going to change when it impacts somebody high up in the company, when it's their kid or when it's their family member's kid. And now suddenly all of those privacy issues are going to sort of blend to the side, because now it's their little Johnny or Susie or Sarah, whoever it may be. And oh my gosh, we need to do something to protect this child. And so for me, it's that personalization of it that you need to get to, because right now it's just that nameless, faceless child, and that's not carrying sway, unfortunately.
One of the things that strikes me about this is that often it's the very same providers who have argued so vociferously against any regulation of their business and any regulation of what types of things come into their business, who are now then shouting about privacy. And it's like, no, wait a minute. The reason everyone feels that their privacy has been encroached on is because you guys have argued for deregulation all this time. And it's the wild, wild west out on the internet. If there had been more regulation, as in some European countries, we might not be sitting here having this conversation to begin with. And so it's frustrating, because I feel like there's a level of I mean, I'm not saying these haven't been helpful to law enforcement in the past or other things, but there is a level of hypocrisy in this. Suddenly they're all about privacy now, while at the same time being all about deregulation, you know. So for some of our listeners, I think that the New York Times article, I don't know, a year ago or a year or two ago, which was really talking about the explosion in abusive images, caught a lot of people by surprise. I think, you know, if you've worked in the field, you certainly know that that's a routine part of cases, but may not have realized just the sheer volume of that. Can you just talk about that? Because it seemed to, I think for a lot of professionals, not that it came out of nowhere, but on the one hand, there was a period of time in which this involved some of your cases. And then now it seems to be something you at least have to ask about or look for in every case.
I agree. And you probably remember me from the days when I was first on board saying we really need to incorporate technology into CACs. This should be something that we work with. And I've been in presentations all over this awesome country of ours. And that's been my message no matter where I go, which is if you don't ask about technology, number one, you're probably missing out on some key corroborative evidence. And number two, you could potentially be missing crimes, especially today. When you look at 2022 and the role of technology in our daily lives, it's harder to come up with somebody who doesn't have technology, who isn't using technology, not only on a daily basis, but on an hourly basis or every 15 minutes. I mean, the studies that have come out about people using their devices, especially since COVID has, you know, just rampaged our country, in the sheer number of additional technology devices that are entering the marketplace and being used, this isn't a surprise to those of us who sort of follow this. I think the surprise is the actual exponential growth. I was just looking at a thing that said that in the last 2 years, NCMEC was reporting a 37% increase in the cyber tips. And on the one hand, I say that that's surprising. But on the other hand, I say, no, it's really not, because we're now all tied to our devices even more so, because things that we used to do out in public, we can't. So we're in our homes a lot more. And so we're using technology. Our screen time has gone up. And so the fact that there is more screen time, there's more children on screen time, they're now used to it for schools. And so it's become second nature to them. And so it's one of those things for me that it matches in terms of the volume, it matches what we do with technology. And so I think it was 2 years ago now that for the first time in sort of the history of the statistics that they keep, screen time surpassed adult TV viewing time. And
oh,
so people were more, yes, people spent more time attached to a screen outside of work. So this wasn't work. And it was so just use of screen time. And it was over, I believe it was about 3 hours and 45 minutes to 3 hours and 20 minutes or something like that. And the numbers have continued to go that way, where you have more screen time, whether it's a laptop or a tablet or a mobile device, a smartphone, but we see people on those more. And as we get to more and more development of better apps, we see people spending most of their time on those, whether they're on a tablet or a smartphone. 90% of the time that they're on those devices is spent within an app or apps, so to speak, as opposed to opening up my mobile web browser and going out and looking at the internet on that. So I know what apps I want. I download the apps, whether I'm playing games or I'm on social media or I'm doing, you know, news searches or weather searches, whatever it may be, it's within an app as opposed to the internet. So that's one of the big changes we've seen as well.
You know, it's just so interesting to think about just what you're saying, that it's really the changes in society as a whole that also drive the changes in child abuse cases as much as anything. There's this cultural component to it. When you think about the federal resources that are available to help combat these crimes, you know, and don't want you to get you in any trouble here, but I mean, are they really up to the challenge? And by that, I don't mean entities, I mean the dollars, because it feels to me like maybe they're a little mismatched these days.
There's no question. There's no question. If you look, and I can't remember the funding this year because I looked at it very briefly, and it is higher. I will say that I was pleasantly surprised to see that it is higher. But I'll go back to, I remember when I first started at NDAA, one of my first meetings was being over at the Department of Justice with one of the funding agencies within the Department of Justice. And they were talking about splitting up the pie, if you will, to all of the ICAC task forces. And they had this X amount of money, and it was doubled because of one of the acts that had just passed. And I can't remember which one it was at the time, but it had just doubled. And so they had all this extra money. And so they were giving more money out. And I think back to, and I'm almost positive it was $61 million or something along those lines. And I look back and I say, where is it now? And it's really not that much higher in most cases. And in many cases, it's actually lower. So the pie has shrunk, even though we now are dealing with something that is literally hundreds of times larger than what it was. You certainly have a more concerted effort from all of the federal investigative agencies, which is incredible. And that's awesome. But as we know from those who are in the field, if you look at the percentages of cases and where those cases end up, it may start as a federal investigation, but a lot of times it will be handed off to a state or local affiliate. And then they're tasked with taking over that investigation, taking over that prosecution. And the numbers, the last time I checked, it was like 90% to 10%, and it may be getting slightly smaller than that. To answer your question succinctly, no, the money is not nearly enough, but it's a question of how much money would be enough. And certainly more would help, whether you're talking about on the agency side or on the training side, the ability to have more people, to have more capabilities and if you will, physical plants available to agencies to combat these issues is definitely what's needed.
Do you think that policymakers, I mean, I'm just curious about what your thought is about why there isn't more. I mean, you know, the fact is when Congress wants to find money for something, they do. And so I'm just wondering, do you think it's that this sometimes can be hard to understand if you don't understand technology, or do you think it's that people feel just overwhelmed by it? Just, this is everywhere. The numbers are so large. We feel helpless, hopeless, or do you feel like it's something else? I mean, what do you think this is rooted in, where you have this, you know, explosion in terms of the amount of CSAM material and everything else, and yet the dollars are growing in this very incremental way, as you're describing, that just can't keep up with the volume that we have?
To me, it's kind of a combination of those. I wish there was like one factor we could point to and say, let's focus on this and let's fix this. And then we'll be able to, you know, open the floodgates in terms of funding. But there are so many different nuances to this. The moment you start talking about anything with technology, as you know, you run into some groups that are very, very, very well organized and have the ears of people because they have some incredibly deep pockets behind them. And they want to make sure that the money that's going out is only for very narrow purposes and that we're not expanding police powers and we're not expanding. I read somewhere the other day that the surveillance state, which just cracks me up a little bit. Because when you look at it, it's the government buying access to the third party people who are already doing this. So if you're
already doing the surveillance, right?
Correct. and the aggregation. So if I'm a billionaire, I can go to Google and say, I want to buy all your data, right? For a certain amount of money. And I say Google, just using it as an example. I'm not saying this is happening at Google, so nobody gets mad at me. But I go to a big internet service provider and I say, I'll give you X amount of money. In my shop, I have a bunch of really smart software programmers who have developed algorithms and AI, so artificial intelligence tools that can cull through that data. And then I can turn around and sell that to marketers, to all these different entities, one of which just happens to be law enforcement. And now there's this huge pushback at law enforcement for taking advantage of something that's available to any private company that's out there. And so to me, it's one of those where you're setting up again, like that awful dichotomy of, oh, well, it's okay over here, but yet again, not over here. And so anytime that these issues get in front of Congress, they really get bottled up in that whole privacy fight and that whole idea of, is this going to impact, you know, somebody's right to have their encrypted data, or is this simply just a way to help the police be better at what they're doing? Is this a way to get more victim services money out there in the field so that we can have the appropriate response to these situations? Little plug for where I am now. We have these tools that if you are the victim of an online event, we'll say, where somebody, you know, takes over some of your social media stuff, there are these tools that can walk you through how to fix that. And so it's the idea of being able to get access to that type of tool and that type of technology. And so for me, the funding really needs to be on two parts. Number one, it's education of the public in general about what we really see with these. Because as you know, there is still that belief of, oh, these really aren't that bad. These are just artistic images and videos that have gone too far, which that's the other sort of really awful trend that we've seen now for the last 15 years, which is, if somebody referred to it, and I thought this was a nice way to say it, the darkening of the internet, which is that things are getting much worse in terms of the type of content we're seeing. And so to educate the public about that and how that's happening, and to be able to then give law enforcement the funding to have the bodies, because this is the other fun thing that a lot of people don't realize. So we spend a lot of money to get a police officer or an investigator trained up in how to be a digital evidence examiner, whether it's a mobile device or a laptop, whatever it may be. And as soon as we get them trained up, there is a six-figure offer waiting for them from the technology world or from the banking industry or from a security industry, because they have skills that translate for them. And so even as soon as you get people trained up, you lose them over to the private sector. And so when we look at sort of that sort of vicious cycle that occurs in this, it makes it really difficult. And some chiefs just want to throw, you know, their hat into the proverbial fire and say, I can't win. Like I agreed, I spent the money, I did what we needed to do. I have this wonderful lab that we created, but now I don't have any bodies to be in there because I can't match anywhere close to what these tech companies are paying. And it's across the board. If you go out and you look at any of the third parties out there, like Glassdoor and things like that, to look at salaries, and you look at starting tech salaries, they are through the roof. That creates another issue with this too, a fine little nuance that gets thrown in.
Yes, there's the issue of not having the resources to begin with, and then not having the resources to pay people at market rate so that you're constantly in the business of losing people as soon as you get them trained. I think that's a great point. You know, you were talking a minute ago about what the general public doesn't seem to understand about this or what they may have misconceptions about. And I'm wondering, you know, you've given plenty of presentations in the past that were to the general public or to parents. What is it you think so key for them to know and understand right now?
Thank you for that question, because that is the thing that I have, the one message I have tried to consistently spread to parents anytime that I get the opportunity to go and speak to them is communication. You have to be in communication with your children. I've seen lots of articles talk about monitoring, and I really don't like the word monitoring because that makes it seem like it's almost an antagonistic relationship. I love some of the newer articles that are coming out and the newer sort of tips that are coming out that talk about we're in this together. So learn together, make this a family event, make this a family function where we go and we look at different things and we see how they work and we talk through it. And so for me, I'll use the example. And before we started talking today, we were catching up and reminiscing about my children who you have known since before they were born. And I was talking about our 11-year-old being into coding. And one of the games that she loves is Roblox. And one of the sites she loves is Roblox, which has a whole bunch of different features to it. And if I just didn't monitor anything, she could be friended by anyone. She could be talking to anyone. But there are certain parental controls. And I've talked her through that. And I've said, this is why we're doing these things. And so it's opening that up. And so she knows this is why we do that. And so with her friends, they can get on FaceTime. And while they're playing the game Roblox, they can have the communication where there's nobody else that's going to be involved in that. And so we don't have to worry about that person saying, hey, come over to this other site that we see. And so for me, it's, and people will say, oh, well, you have a technology background. I didn't. Before I started as a prosecutor, I didn't have a tech background. I wasn't a computer science major in college. This is all learned on the job. And so with my child, I'm lucky to be able to understand what it is she's learning about. But I still ask her questions about it all the time because there's different pieces and aspects to it that I'm aware of, but I don't have the knowledge to really know what they are until I go back and look at it. But again, that all goes back to that idea of communication, of knowing what they're doing. And I use this sort of ridiculous example Anytime I talk and I say, how many of you have like in your head, you have that dream car that if you won a lottery tomorrow, they would be in your driveway. And people, you can see in their faces as they're reacting to it. And they're like, oh yeah, I got that. And I said, okay, how many of you would take your 15-year-old and say, before you take any driver's ed, here are the keys to my brand new car. Have a good time. And everybody in the audience looks at me like I have three heads. Like, no, I would never do that. And I said, so why would you then turn around and say, here's a tablet, here's a phone, which can be just as deadly. In fact, it could be even worse because it gives an outsider the ability to get into your child's bedroom if that's where your child is talking from. And so why do we think it's okay to do that? And why are we okay to say, oh, well, you show me how that works? And so for me, it's not a monitoring situation. It's a obligation as a parent when, you know, we sign that thing that said, I'm going to be a parent and I'm going to do the right things that we all signed before our children were born. And I say that with tongue in cheek.
If only there was such a document.
I agree, but we have this obligation to know what they're doing. That doesn't mean that, you know, you're a hawk and you're watching over them 24/7. Some of you may have kids that you're like, oh yes, I am. And so that may be that situation, but there's others that you're like, no. And what you'll find is that if you normalize the conversation, this doesn't become a situation where your child feels like they're being targeted or persecuted. And so the more that you know, the better it sort of makes these conversations go. And I'm going to throw out a name of a place that I always send people. And no, they don't pay me anything. I don't have any financial interest in them. So we can get all of that out of the way. But commonsense.org, which is Common Sense Media, and they do every 3 years, I think it is, they do kind of a study of kids from birth to eight. And that's phenomenal. And there's great research in there. But they also have all these great tools for looking at, you know, what are the current apps? What are kids doing? What kind of things are they interested in? And so it's just a really nice non-techie way for parents to understand what kids are doing. And they do stay pretty current in terms of what's out there. So commonsense.org is usually like the first place that I start people with. And there's books and things like that out there too that, you know, are available for parents. And a really good one that I think was just on one of the Harvard talks a few weeks ago, if I remember correctly, is called The Connected Parent. And it's an expert guide to parenting in a digital world. And it's another one. It kind of breaks down some what some people might think as complex topics and makes it a little bit easier to understand. Now, I'm not saying run out and buy this. I'm just saying these are just some of the things that are out there that are available. I'm trying to remember the American Academy of Pediatrics has a website called, I'm going to mess this up, Healthy Children, I think it is. Hold on, I think I may still have it up. I do. It is healthychildren.org, and it is all of the American Academy of Pediatrics sponsored things that are okay for kids. And so they've got some really good tools in there too. And so for me, it's setting kind of those boundaries with kids. And it all goes back to that original word, which is communication.
I really like your point about this, you know, normalizing the conversation early so it doesn't become adversarial about it. So kids aren't feeling like they need to hide something from their parents about communication that's already, you know, happening. But kids are aware that there are safety concerns with the internet. And just in the same way that you would, you know, discuss with your kids safety concerns about going off with their friends or traveling or other kinds of things, this can just be a part of that same sort of conversation that one might have about that. And I really appreciate about the fact that you make it sound very easy, even for parents who may not have a lot of technology background, because I do think that that is what keeps a lot of parents from really talking to their kids. They're afraid they're going to appear stupid in front of their kids, you know, or not understand something. And their kids are going to be like, oh, mom, I already knew that and whatever. But it's just like, this is so key because kids are going to be attached to these devices basically forever. So we want them to be safe. Turning to professionals right now for a moment. You know, you've got an audience of Children's Advocacy Center staff and MDT members and other child abuse professionals. What do you think that we should be most paying attention to right now in the space? I mean, aside from just, you know, making sure that when we're conducting interviews, we're making sure to ask kids about technology and devices. Beyond that, what else do you think that we should be paying attention to?
There's two parts to that. And I'll start with the end part first, which is a little bit easier, which is the sort of wrapping up of the forensic interview. One of the things that I would love to see kind of across the country at all the CACs, and the people that are at the CACs are wonderful. And I constantly am singing their praises and talking about what an amazing, amazing job they're doing. But in that interview, in terms of that closure piece, if you will, and when we're sending that child back out of the room, one of the things I wish would just be sort of a standard discussion would be talking about technology use and what happens if you feel like you're in over your head. To be able to say to children, there are resources. So if you are approached, if you get into a situation where you may have already done the thing that you're like, oh God, if my parents find out about this, I am in so much trouble, that you don't feel like you are in a corner. And so that whether it's bullying or whether it's child created material, where they have, you know, maybe volunteered or been, I don't like the word groomed, but manipulated into giving this material or creating this material. And so in those situations, having just a sort of a standard line that we talk about to say, by the way, you know, I hope you're aware of, and to be able to give them a couple resources. And to me, that is, I think, critical, because it helps kids. Anytime I've ever spoken to kids and I get the question, and this, I'll never forget this. This was before I left the state's attorney's office. We were talking to parents and the eighth graders about suicide, because there had been a tragic situation where an eighth grader had committed suicide in the community that I live in. And one of my friends is one of the school counselors there. And she said, can you come be part of this panel? And I don't want to denigrate any of the other people on the panel, but a child raised her hand, a little girl, very, very bright and a sweet girl. And she said, what can we do? Like, what do we do if we're in a situation where we're either being bullied or a friend of ours is being bullied? And how do we deal with that? And I didn't say anything at first because I wanted to hear what the panelists had to say. And they were these really esoteric answers that were talking about, well, we should have a group discussion and all these things. And so I let them all finish, and I just sort of raised my hand and said, you know, I would just like to talk about a couple of practical steps you could take. And I said, I don't know if you have ever done this, but if you scroll down to the bottom of the website, when you're in whatever different group, whatever website you choose, social media, whatever it is, there's always a little contact us button down there. And if you click on that, it'll take you through some choices. And one of those choices in almost every one of these is, I'm being bullied. And this gives you, this empowers you to do something about it. So whether it's actually at you or it's a friend of yours that this is happening to, and they are brave enough to talk to you about it, you have the ability to do something. And so you do have a choice here. You do have something that can actually make a tangible difference. And so for me, and I still do this, and I'm going to Nebraska next week, and it's one of the slides that I just did, because I had to go create all the new slides to match their new API. Every time they change how it looks for us on the front side, you have to go in and change the slides so that people are like, wait, this doesn't look like this. And so I was just going in on some of the more popular social networking sites, and I was finding that exact place, because that's one of the messages that I try and get across. And so that to me is a huge piece of this. Arm these kids with the ability to make a difference. They want to step up. They want to help. They want to be able to have that outlet. Then on the other side of the coin, it's asking those questions and looking for and paying attention to, and when I say those questions, it's just about technology use in general. When we start to talk about technology use in general, and we just ask five or six questions in a forensic interview, what you will see is a reaction from a child of either, if it's a child who's interested in technology, they open up and they just start talking about it. But from an investigative standpoint, if you're watching that interview and there's anything in those answers that just kind of clicks and sets off your spidey sense, if you will, to me, that's the moment when we know there's something there. We know there's something else. And it could be something as simple as saying, the child saying, oh yeah, he would make me watch like the wrestling on his computer. Well, what kind of wrestling? Well, nobody had any clothes on, which was weird, right? And so instantaneously, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, okay, there's a computer or some sort of tablet involved. He's showing this child pornography as a means to sort of seduce this child and get them to normalize the idea of it's okay to engage in this behavior. And so it's those sort of steps to get to the hands-on offenses, if you will. And so from an investigator standpoint, it's just thinking about technology use and listening to and paying attention to those, and it may be nonverbal cues during that interview. Like if you see a hitch or a, you know, they're going to talk and then they stop, usually there's something there. Usually there's something there where it doesn't want to say, oh gosh, if I talk about this, I lose my phone or something along those lines. So that's one of the things I would say. The other thing is I would add is kids are going to have a lot more technology expertise than we are. So we can't try and be cool with this. We can't be like, look at what I know. You know, that's going to backfire on us no matter how we try to do that. Like anytime I do that with my kid, she just laughs at me. It's like, oh, dad. And so it's one of those things where, you know, she knows I know more than her right now, but she's catching up. And so with kids, it's one of those things where it's okay to admit, hey, you know, I don't really understand all that. Could you kind of talk me through that? And when you look at the way gaming consoles have changed and how much more now they are reliant on chat and live interaction, that to me kind of goes right into what we're talking about here, where traditionally we'd say, oh, you're like gaming. Okay. Well, now we know there's a couple things we need to follow up on. What kind of gaming? Is it just on your phone or is this actually a console? Is this something you're logging in? Well, have you talked to anybody on there? Have they suggested you go anywhere? Oh, now we're in Discord or one of the other places that are out there that really sort of merge with these gaming consoles. So it's just really kind of asking the questions. I wish there was like a catch-all that I could give and say, oh yeah, just ask this question and you're going to find your treasure trove of evidence or information. But it's more so just don't be afraid to introduce the idea of technology into the forensic interview.
Well, and kids themselves, you know, will tell you, you know, as you're like, well, what is that? Kids like to be expert and tell you things.
Absolutely. So
it's an interesting thing. You know, I was thinking as you were talking about it at the end of the interview, you know, often we do other kinds of safety planning with kids at the end of the interview, right? And so this is just an add-on to that, to sort of expand the sense of when we're thinking about next steps in safety planning, that also includes technology because a person could reach right back out to them, you know, after the forensic interview or even during the forensic interview for that matter. And so thinking about that as you're conducting one is important. I mean, I always find these conversations, Justin, an equal mixture of terrifying and enlightening whenever we talk about technology. I'm just wondering, is there any question that out of my ignorance of technology, I should have asked you and didn't, or anything else you want to make sure that we talk about before we end our conversation today?
The one thing I don't want to leave people with, because what you just said is something that I hear all the time, that especially in places where I've spoken more than once, I was like, oh, it's so fascinating what you talk about, but I'm always so scared every time you open your mouth. And I don't want to have that effect. I don't want it to be that people throw in the towel and like, oh, there's nothing we can do. I want it to be the reverse of that. The reason to talk about this is to develop an awareness and an eye-opening to say, okay, this does exist, but it's not that it is a unclimbable mountain, right? We can't get to the summit of this. We can. It's just, as I said, opening the conversation. It's for us as adults, playing with different types of technology, figuring out what's out there. Yeah, you're going to make a fool of yourself, but we all do that all the time anyway. You know, think back to when you first learned to ride a bike. Were you like that one in a gazillion child that didn't fall over, right? We have these sort of steps that we have to take and missteps, if you will, as we evolve. And so that's just a part of this as we learn about technology. How many people today would think, 4 years ago, I'm going to really understand how Zoom works and I'm going to be really good at Zoom meetings and I'm going to know how to get to these emojis and what they all mean. But with COVID, we had to adapt. And this is nothing more than adapting when it comes to this. And so that's why things like Common Sense Media or iKeepSafe or NetSmarts with NCMEC, there are different resources that are out there. And of course, if anybody ever needs to contact me, I'm happy to send a list of different things that they can go to, whether they're looking for studies or they're looking for actual resources that they can give out to parents. You do have to just sort of keep up with this. That doesn't mean this is all you're doing, but it's just a you know, every once in a while doing a Google search to say, you know, what are kids interested in with technology? And then reading through and seeing those. I never thought gaming would take off as much as it has, but it's, if you talk about children and the number of hours that are on there, it's the number one thing that they're doing. And it's not just boys. It used to be boys at 97%. Now girls are at 95%. So they have caught up and they are just as interested. Our little girl loves coding and loves playing people's games to see if she could figure out how to incorporate from a coding perspective some of the challenges that other people create. So, and improve upon those. So it's one of those things where, you know, how many people today would have said 3 years ago, or well, maybe I'll go 4 years ago, let's talk about TikTok, right? But now that's a common word, right? And people are constantly watching TikTok videos wherever I go. And I see the, you know, 8 second clips or whatever they may be as I'm walking past their phones, and it just makes me chuckle. And so it's just kind of adapting to what we see happening and what becomes popular.
Well, when this is over, I'm going to Google the very things that you suggested and try to at least up my own knowledge a little bit. And hopefully all our listeners will too. I so appreciate you coming on and talking about this. I think whether we want to think it is or not, it's very much a part of our world, a part of our cases and what kids are dealing with every day. So thank you for helping keep them so much safer by talking about it. Appreciate it, Justin.
Oh, thank you. As I said at the beginning, thank you so much for the opportunity. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, and especially about a topic near and dear to my heart.
Thank you for listening to 1 in 10. If you like this episode, please share it with your team. And for more information about this episode and all of our others, please visit our podcast website at www.1in10podcast.org.